This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. In 2008, even the most remote countries fell victim to the global economic crisis. Indeed, it was Iceland that suffered relatively the largest collapse in the world. That country owed foreign investors 50 billion euros, which is six times the size of Iceland's entire gross domestic product. The catastrophe prompted protest.
They got angry and got out on the streets and demanding for changes.
Protest they did. They wanted a new constitution, and they used the internet and crowdsourcing to make a campaign to build support. A documentary called Blueberry Soup follows Iceland's economic collapse and the attempt to rewrite its governing document. Blueberry Soup will be screened tonight at 6:30 on the East Campus of Duke University. But first, the filmmaker is with us, Eileen Jarrett. She joins us on the State of Things. Hi, Eileen. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Also with me is Duke Political Science and Philosophy Professor Michael Gillespie. Michael, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to see you, Frank.
Eileen, I think to understand this movie, because this is really a film about the response to the collapse in Iceland, but we need to backtrack a little bit and talk about the impact on Iceland and how it was that they had essentially, as I say, relatively speaking, the kind of the worst effects of 2008. What happened in Iceland?
So what happened in 2008 is three of the major banks in Iceland went belly up. What happened after that is that the nation was responsible for debt that far exceeded what this generation or the following generation or many generations after that would be able to pay for. So people that had mortgages on their house was now two or three times more expensive than it was. So people were losing their homes. They were wondering, what's the future of our society? A lot of people were considering moving. There was a lot of despair and a lot of anger in the air.
And the reason that Iceland was so deeply affected by this is they changed some of their banking laws in order to get in on the action. Things were booming up until then, if everybody remembers. And they had to relax some of their banking laws in order to play the big global game, right?
That's right. And this is what happens when they denationalize the banks, and then you have money that's not really accounted for. So we hear stories from the Icelandic account where they were going to New York, people would fly to New York City and have pizza with gold flakes on it. And farmers and fishermen were taking out second and third homes, and people would get phone calls from these banks saying, would you like to get a loan? No, we don't need to check your credit. Just we'll give you some money. Let's have some fun. And there wasn't enough people asking the questions, where is this money coming from? Why are we being lent this money? It was just a very abundant time.
Which is what you do when you have a national bank accountable to the people. And, of course, that was the system up until then.
That's
then
right.
Things collapse. And in the immediate aftermath, describe for us what happened in the immediate aftermath.
So in the immediate aftermath, as you can imagine, there was a tremendous amount of frustration. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of mistrust with the government. You had thousands of people showing up to Parliament and protesting, demanding that the figureheads that were in charge step down and give the people a chance to decide what future they might have after this.
And what you said is important. It's one thing to be angry about your situation. People were losing their homes on a huge scale. The rug had been pulled out from everybody. So you can get angry, you can point fingers. But in the midst of this, people began to recognize that it was precisely that they didn't have control of government. Not that the people in charge had messed things up, but that we're not running things, that democracy may be the answer here.
That's right. And there was something really exciting happening. And that's kind of where I came in, is that there was this undertone of, what can we do differently? How can we not just make sure this never happens again, but let's look at even the larger problems at hand and how can we reimagine society? As one of the members said, you know, what kind of nation do you want to live in?
Well, you spoke with a lot of people for this film. It's a fascinating picture of what happened afterwards. I want to listen to one man that you spoke with, a musician, who you say made a point that you heard over and over again.
And even if times are good, people are still like, oh, I don't have time. I don't have time for these ambiguities. I need a strong leader. I can't be bothered with all these decisions and all these opinions I'm supposed to have and all these discussions we need. And I just think those people aren't ready for a democracy. Democracy means not having strong leaders, but having strong people that think for themselves and are ready to change their opinions. The best thing in the world is to be able to say, I was wrong about this guy. I was wrong about this decision.
That's a clip from Blueberry Soup, which you can see tonight at 6:30 at White Auditorium at Duke University. The filmmaker is with me, Eileen Jarrett. When did you learn about that? What brought you to Iceland in the first place?
Well, that's a great question. What had brought me there in the first place was not what kept me there. I wanted to document possibly how the art would change in Iceland during a time of such chaos. It went from this very ethereal, floaty, beautiful, delicate work, and I thought maybe it would turn into this political, angsty, messagey music. And it wasn't necessarily the case. Instead, what I found was a large society of creative minds trying to reimagine their government and try to reimagine the structures that weren't working and how everybody could be involved in the discussion of changing that system.
And when you say everybody, we should say that we're talking about a nation of 300,000 people, so roughly the size of the population of Durham, North Carolina, or Winston-Salem, right?
That's right.
And it's an isolated country. So there is to some degree some homogeneity, although you encountered that question as well, because we might be tempted to say, well, 300,000 people all living together for that long, yeah, sure, they can get along well together.
Absolutely. But one of the ironic things is since we've been screening this film, the first comment I hear is, oh, Iceland was able to do it. They were only 300,000. You know, but we could never do it here in the States. We're too divided. We're too diverse. Our opinions are far too separate. And we'll never come to consensus. But then when I was in Iceland during this drafting process, I heard people say, oh, we'll never get this draft to the table. We'll never get a chance to rewrite our Constitution. We're too divided. We're too different. We're too diverse. So, you know, there's really some parallels happening here that when you start talking negative about what we're capable of.
Tell us about the process. Tell us what happened next, this democracy process.
So this is fascinating. What they did was they'd elected 25 individuals. The only mandate was they could not be bankers and they could not be politicians to rewrite the nation's constitution. The constitution was never Icelandic. It was a Dutch constitution that had been handed, or a Danish constitution, sorry, handed over. And it was never supposed to be the Icelandic constitution. This was supposed to be rewritten a long time ago. And they never really got the opportunity to bring this to the table. So now here was a chance. And the council ended up being this extremely eclectic array of people. It was farmers. It was radio announcers, mathematicians, pastors, lawyers, students. Even there was someone on the Constitutional Council that believed very firmly in keeping the old constitution. So you had a very large group to participate in the discussion of what this draft should look like. People that believed you should concentrate on dividing the powers. People that believed you should start talking about the power of money in that place in society. The power of media. And so they were a lot of people that had different interests going into it, but their main mandate was, let's come to consensus. No matter what, we're going to be friends in this, and we're going to discuss things with respect to each other and to our country.
And when you talk about the mandate and the process, 25 people chosen at random, what is this process? Because it is not a parliamentary, the all thing, which is what the parliament is called. They didn't do this. So this thing grew from the ground up. How did it even get organized?
So this all came to be from a very interesting process. 1,000 Icelanders were picked at random to come together to congregate for a couple days and discuss, what do you need to see change in your country to be able to move forward? What kinds of things need to happen for you to feel confident in the society? And one of the things was, we need to rewrite the Constitution. And in this 1,000 group, they decided the main principles that would be discussed in the Constitution. So this gave a period of time for constitutional specialists to start organizing that information for these 25 to be able to kind of update them on, here's how you write a constitution. Here are the things that you need to look out for in the future.
This is a grassroots movement. It is a kind of extra legal, outside the legal system movement, but it is robust and it's being taken seriously. I want to find out what happens now as it starts to move closer to the political process itself. You spoke with a member of the Ministry of Ideas. They have one there, which is to their credit, that there is a Ministry of Ideas. But here's what he had to say about the new constitution.
They just didn't believe the system that would actually crash. That was because there weren't enough information lying around to build on good policy making. And that is why we think, for example, open source governance and crowdsourcing and so on will be the next revelation in politics. And we are finding a strong current in Icelandic politics to look into that kind of governance.
There's a clip from Blueberry Soup that screens tonight at 6:30 on Duke University's East Campus. Michael Gillespie is here, and he is a political science and philosophy professor, and this is part of your idea. This is part of a whole series on democracy. Tell us a little bit about why you're screening this film and more about the series itself.
Well, the film is fascinating in part because Iceland is fascinating. It was the first Republican proto-democracy in the modern world, going back to 930 when the Althing was first put in place. And it was a participatory system even then. Now, that's obviously an advantage being in a small society as opposed to a large society. But even then, there was tremendous diversity. And the Icelandic sagas, for example, tell about the conflict between different people in different areas in Iceland going back to then. But they understood that they had to rule in a collective fashion and try to reach consensus on issues. And this, of course, is in a globalizing world, a very important question for how we're going to go forward.
I was going to say, why does this story, this particular story of 300,000 people located in this isolated place, why is it relevant to students at Duke University or any of the rest of us here in North Carolina?
Well, as we move from an era in which we've been dependent upon a print culture to a more electronic culture that began first with television but which has really exploded with the development of the internet, we really have to look at new ways in which we have public spaces where we can talk about politics. The more we live online, the more people focus on their Facebook accounts, their Twitter accounts, the more that's going to be the public space in which politics takes place. We've already seen that in the Middle East with the Arab Spring, and it continues to be a phenomenon around the world. And I think Iceland is a case in which we can look and see how this might actually work in a positive manner as opposed to just a destructive manner.
Well, it's a good comparison to make. The Arab Spring, there was a great burst of activity, democratic activity that caused change, and then we saw essentially a retreat to the status quo. What's happening in Iceland now after the Pots and Pan Revolution and the Constitutional Assembly?
So do you mean what had happened after
I mean, did it result in change? Where is the Constitution now?
Oh, so I'm sad and happy to tell you this news. The Constitution currently is in a bit of a constitutional purgatory. So what happened is there was a national referendum. The people voted, and they voted yes. So that was amazing.
By a big number.
By quite a large number. Mm-hmm. And so then it was brought to the parliament, and it was tabled. So they've never been able to actually vote on it. And it's been caught up in a lot of controversy, but it's just not been voted on.
And there is a process, of course. You can have the referendum, but then it does have to be approved by Parliament,
the whole
thing, and it wasn't. So, Michael, this is what you say is points to sort of one of the failures of the process itself. Tell us more about that.
Well, changing any existing political institution means fighting against prevailing interests. And those interests are awfully powerful. One only has to think about attempts to change healthcare in the United States to see how powerful the pharmacy industry, the insurance industry is in trying to really prevent any kinds of changes, even though everybody recognizes they would be to the general benefit.
So, and in this case, was the group working on the constitutional convention, this grassroots group, what kind of contact did they have with members of parliament to get support along the way? Because you can imagine, you know, at some point you're going to have to pass it off to parliament. Were they working together in this process?
Well, the intention with that's actually a really great question, was if they could involve the public as much as possible, they thought, for sure, we will have the support of the parliament because this is a direct relationship with the society. So one of the ways that they went about that is they put the draft online while they were writing it. So people from anywhere in the actual world could comment in real time on the draft and talk about the language being used, make little amendments, and that would be talked about directly while they would be in session. And I thought that was phenomenal. And they'd use also Facebook and Twitter in the same way, such as in the beginning of the day, they would say, today we're going to talk about the welfare of children. What are your thoughts? And they would reference people directly, say, oh, Jonas in the West Fjords thinks that we should maybe add this part, not talking about what is his education? What is his background? You know, who is this Jonas? Instead, they said, he has an idea, and that's important. And so with that thought, they said, if we bring all of this collective information to the parliament in the end, there's just no way that they're going to say no. But that's one of the criticisms, is that they should have involved the parliament more throughout the process.
Well, and of course, the way to involve the parliament going forward is to vote them out. So then what you'd have to see, and again, going back to the Arab Spring, that the movement has to continue and go the next step and show that it was at your peril that you didn't approve this constitution. So what's happening, Michael? Do you think in – I mean – you talked about the value of and this new public space. On the other hand, the criticism of that space is that it is the ultimate distraction. That's why movements fall apart, because it's easy to write a three-sentence line about what should be in the Constitution, then go back to work and forget about the process.
Well, I think it was a good process. I think they did the right things. I think, unfortunately, the political – existing political powers – don't have to be as worried about that, because things in Iceland have gotten a lot better economically. And, you know, like in America, people really care about the economy in terms of going forward. So there hasn't been as much pressure to change, because people have settled back, I think, into a kind of sense of the status quo is not as bad as it was. Now, you know, whether or not that will continue as they go forward, whether the economy will continue to prosper, that's, of course, problematic. But I think it's a really important thing that that constitution is still sitting there and can still be approved by the parliament. And that may actually change the way in which the parliament does business, just because they know the alternative is out there.
Well, but the reason for the protest, obviously, a lot of people were out of work and very angry. They're not as angry now, as Michael suggests. The economy is doing better. Is there a kind of a base group that has moved the movement forward and continues to see these structural changes as critical? Is there a group behind it?
A couple of the members of the Constitutional Council are still very actively involved in trying to bring this back to the table. One of the chances that it has to be resurrected is if a new government is elected, one that has a platform of standing for let's bring this constitutional reform to a vote. So it does stand a chance. There is also a group that started that pulled from the constitutional draft one of the amendments, which was media transparency. So knowing who owns the media, what are the connections, and why you might be getting the type of information that you're getting. So that group is taking that one aspect and running with it. And they've actually had great success so far in bringing that into parliamentary votes.
It has the movement itself refocused its attention to parliament and creating the kind of pressure that would force an election.
No, like Michael was saying, right now, I mean, I look at it as this is part of a process. This is part of the process. It gets caught up in the bureaucracy, but we have to keep moving forward. And you do have a small group of driven individuals that are trying to bring this back in. Right now, the current parliament, you don't see a majority supporting this or talking about it, which is even worse, just not talking about it like it never existed. And in a time of healing, when things are better and they're on the rise, there's not so much of a discussion of what do we need to change, what do we need to do.
Michael, are there lessons that we can draw from this generally as Americans from this story, or is this simply an isolated event?
Well, I think it does tell us something about the electronic world that we live in, which is that there are possibilities for constructive action in there, that it doesn't just have to be critical and cynical and destructive. You know, we learned in the Arab Spring that Twitter and Facebook and a lot of other electronic means can be used to pull governments down. They haven't been very successful in putting them back together. I think this is one way in which we can think about that. I think it's a way in which we can think about political debate in the future, certainly on the local level, but maybe even on the national level. And you see that in some of the town meeting kinds of institutions that parties have been putting into place.
Well, thank you both for being on the program. Michael Gillespie, a political science and philosophy professor at Duke University. Michael, thank you.
Thank you.
And Eileen Jarrett, whose newest film is called Blueberry Soup. You can see it tonight, 6:30, White Auditorium at Duke's East Campus. Eileen, thank you for being on the program
as
well.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
If you missed that, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org, for all the details. Just ahead, a reunion of the pioneers of NASCAR. Stay tuned.